He describes the kitchen duties the brother has to do in turn, exactly how much food they're allowed to eat in each meal, how many different dishes. They were also allowed a hemina of wine a day, although he says wine isn't really good for monks, but we know how hard it would be to convince them of otherwise.
Welcome back to Food, a Cultural Culinary History, a podcast brought to you by The Great Courses Plus. I'm Jason Smigel, and like you, I'm a lifelong learner. I've been listening to The Great Courses for over 14 years, and I'm excited to be sharing this great course as a podcast with you. This podcast is hosted by Ken Albala, who's professor of history and chair of food studies at the University of the Pacific. He's also the author of Ken Albala's Food Rant, a highly popular blog for people who love food. Episode 10, Early Christianity, Food Rituals and Asceticism. In today's podcast, we're going to observe the role of food in Jesus's parables and miracles, as well as the ritual of the Eucharist. We'll take a look at early Christian and monastic dietary prescriptions, we'll examine practices regarding ritual fasting in Christianity, and we'll examine the significance of purification through self-denial and practices such as Lent. As always, if you're interested in trying any of Ken's recipes and food experiments, or even seeing photos and illustrations of the concepts that Ken mentions in this podcast, you can find supporting materials for this podcast at thegreatcoursesdaily.com.
Let me start with a disclaimer that my interpretation of the New Testament is solely as a food historian, and it will almost definitely not coincide with the interpretations offered to you by your religious leaders if you happen to be of the Christian faith. So let me kind of apologize in advance. I have a different take on this story. Nor would it even be possible to give you one theological explanation that all denominations could agree upon, especially regarding the topic of the meaning of the Eucharist. And of course, that's still the real dividing line today between Catholics and Protestants. But to begin with, let's think again of the vast Roman Empire. Just at the point that it swept over most of the ancient world and also conquered the Holy Land and incorporated this as a province called Palestine. The Jews were still performing ritual sacrifices, but now they were very much Hellenized and they were speaking Aramaic or even Greek as their language. The Jews also held a kind of tenuous position within the empire. On the one hand, they were allowed relative autonomy, right? They had their own king, that's Herod in this case, kind of a puppet, but, and they also had an imperial governor sent from Rome, that's Pontius Pilate in this story. And they were granted a kind of autonomy partly because they had this vast mercantile links, you know, across the Mediterranean. And the Jews actually made up a good proportion of the entire empire, maybe about 10%. So the emperor wanted to stay on their good side. A large amount of revenue went to Rome from Jewish taxpayers. And in fact, you remember, you know, Jesus tells his disciples, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, even if it came from fishes' mouths. They were good taxpayers. On the other hand, the Jews being monotheistic, they couldn't participate in all the official Roman rites, which recognized the emperor as a semi-divine being. And one more thing, Jewish practice had really changed a great deal since the days of the kingdoms. For one, many Jews lived nowhere near the temple. So a new kind of worship arose, which centered around a synagogue. And that's an interesting term. It's a Greek term, which basically comes to mean school, in which Jewish scholars, rabbis, study the Torah and newer commentaries on the Bible, which are called the Talmud. And the sacrifices, you know, they're still taking place in Jerusalem, but there's a different kind of worship that happens elsewhere, which is very important for our story, because we'll see that many of these synagogues actually become early churches. Another important point is that there also developed different forms of Judaism. You know, groups who wanted to escape what they considered to be the legalistic logic chopping and corruption of the Pharisees. Those are the Orthodox priests running the temple. And they wanted to return to the original intentions of God. And one of these groups, the Essenes, went into the desert, practiced these purification rituals, and one of them involved having water poured over you. John the Baptist was most likely an Essene. I remember him out in the desert eating locusts and wild honey. The Essenes also had these communal feasts. They addressed each other as brother. And the idea is that what really bound these people together was mutual respect and love, not just some physical building where they sacrifice animals and splatter blood on the walls. In other words, the rituals seem to have become empty now, and they wanted to replace them, following the empty letter of the law with a kind of real goodness and morality. And they studied the Bible intensely. In fact, you know the Dead Sea Scrolls. They are one of these desert communes. The Qumran sect made those, copied them out, put them in jars, and hid them in the cave. But keep in mind, the idea of escaping the city and living in holy communities is very, very important for early Christianity. So Jewish practice was changing, and there was a great deal of intellectual and religious ferment, and this is beginning to make the Romans edgy. Okay? I mean, they certainly know the Jews have been prone to rise up in rebellion in the past, and they certainly would be willing to stop anything before it got out of hand. So into this milieu appears a young man, Joshua ben Joseph. His dates are 6 BC to 30 AD. How that happens, I don't know. The calendar starts and he's already 6 years old. But he is basically offering another plan for revitalizing the Jewish religion by scrapping all the legalistic practice of the Pharisees and replacing it with simple rules that people can follow and things that will actually make them better people, like do unto others, etc. And of course, he told these neat little parables that people could understand. And presumably, you know, no one can understand the Talmudic scholarship anymore. And the rituals were in a language few people spoke anymore. And he was figuring they certainly don't make people good. You know, justice, mercy, faith, that's what God wants, not stinking entrails on an altar. Jesus's parables also, they're quite often about food. Think about agricultural tasks and I think they kind of give you a good idea of the type of people he's preaching to. You know, they're simple shepherds, they're farmers and fishermen, and all sorts of food imagery also appears in these parables. You know, new wine into old skins, or the kingdom of heaven is like a net let down into the sea. So only after being dragged ashore are the good ones separated from the bad fish, right? So, and there's also that story, remember the landowner who hires workers for his vineyard, and everyone ends up getting paid the same amount, even the people who show up late? Well, it's a parable not to begrudge what other people get, but it's cast in a form of a situation that I think would have been very familiar to these people. They're farmers and such. And there was another Jewish tradition that Jesus eventually came to be associated with, that one day a Moshiach, or a Messiah, would come to initiate a new era in human history. And in the Jewish tradition, he would be a person sent to teach and change ritual practice once again. So he'd be like another Moses, a new dispensation. He'd be a messenger from God. And there are several sources for this tradition, but they got much of this from the prophecy of Isaiah. If you remember, if you've ever sung the Messiah, you'll remember, you know, lo, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son named Emmanuel. Well, that's directly from the text. And that part of the story, perhaps you're familiar with, but the other side of Jesus's career, I think, is a little harder to explain. You know, apart from these stories, Jesus was really a faith healer and a miracle worker. And most of his miracles either involve healing sick people or feeding people. You remember there's a wedding feast at Cana, and the water miraculously turns into wine. Or the miracle at Bethesda, where there's 5 loaves and only 2 fishes, and they end up feeding 5,000 people. And that's a miracle that's performed several times, which of course makes him a great candidate for the downtrodden and oppressed Jews, because he's also telling them things like, you know, being powerful is not so important. It's the meek that shall inherit the earth. You, because of your goodness, will go to heaven while your oppressors will be in hell. That's a story they would really like to hear. But notice, please, that everything he's saying is very socially subversive. It's not the sort of thing authorities want to hear. You know, either the Jewish priests or the Romans. And keep in mind also, at no point does Jesus ever propose breaking away, forming a separate, entirely new religion. He never even claims to be divine either. What he's called at the time is Son of Man, and that's basically just another name for the Messiah. Explaining that he was actually the Son of God is really the work of his disciples. Remember, he's a Jewish reformer preaching to Jews. It's only later that Paul decides the religion should be open to Jews and Gentiles and anyone who wants to convert. But let's get to the food story. Jesus makes his way to Jerusalem with his 12 disciples. And he causes a row because he gets into the temple and he chases out the moneylenders. And he gets into all sorts of trouble. And he happens to be there during Holy Week also. And the head priest Caiaphas thinks, I don't really want to cause trouble with the authorities. So he figures out a way to bribe one of Jesus's followers. This is Judas Iscariot. And he says, we'll give you this money. I want you to point out which one of these guys, they don't even know which one he is Jesus, so we can arrest him. And as it turns out, that night, the whole crew is there celebrating Passover. And they're eating matzah, they're drinking the requisite 4 glasses of wine, and of course they get quite drunk. They're doing the reclining thing, which is it's interesting. It's why John, he's not just leaning, like you see in Leonardo, Da Vinci's painting of the Last Supper, but he's actually lying down. You remember he's on a couch, he falls asleep next to him. And Jesus stops in the middle of this ceremony and he says, for all you guys care, this bread could be my body. And this wine we're drinking, this could be my blood. So when I'm gone, remember me when you eat and drink. So what does that mean? The disciples think, okay, sure, we'll remember you. Well, this little event, seemingly unimportant at the time, turns out to be the central ritual or sacrament of the new religion. It's called the communion or the Eucharist. That's the Greek word for it. And in all the early churches, they began to perform this ritual of eating and drinking. It wasn't even entirely clear what was happening during the ritual. Was it really just a memorial? Remember me? Was Jesus speaking metaphorically? I'm like wine, I'm like bread. Or were people actually consuming the real body and blood of Jesus? Now, we'll return to this topic when we get to the Reformation, but just realize that down the road, a lot of blood will be shed over this very issue, a food issue. Meanwhile, the disciples are all lying around, completely drunk, in the Garden of Gethsemane. Judas betrays Jesus with a kiss, and then he's dragged off. And he's brought before the priests, and he won't answer their questions. And remember, at this point, he's also being called King of the Jews. So it's very dangerous stuff, and no one really knows what they're supposed to be doing. And so the priests decide we just better hand him over to the Roman governor, Pontius Pilate. And Pilate certainly doesn't want to be blamed if something goes wrong here, so he asks the crowd that's assembled there. And he says, I know it is your custom to let some prisoners free for the holidays. They had 3 prisoners at the time. And he says, should I let this Jesus guy go? And the crowd is thinking, Romans really don't want to let this guy go. And we don't really want to upset the Romans. So they say, no, don't let him go. Crucify him. And Pilate says, fine, you've made the decisions. I wash my hands of the whole thing. This is your choice, not mine. Don't blame me. And as you know, Jesus is, of course, crucified. And what this act does for later Christians is that it completely replaces that ritual sacrifice in the temple. This explains why Jesus was called the Lamb of God and why his sacrificing himself replaced the sacrifice of the scapegoat. It's still a punishment, but it's given to him instead of the goat now. And it serves exactly the same function. Right? Think about it. People do lots of bad things. Someone in the universe must be punished. And in this case, Jesus allows himself to be punished for everyone else's sins. So in a sense, and in fact, Jesus says this himself, that the law is not erased. It's merely fulfilled in a different form, in a new dispensation, and the law is abrogated. And it is exactly the same for all the other laws of the Old Testament. Remember the interesting dietary laws? They are also abrogated. That means it's not done away with. They're changed into a different form. And it's now that we enter into yet another epic of God's dietary plan. Before, the Jews needed all those specific laws, but since they were now following the letter of the law instead of the spirit, it's time to just do away with them all. And again, what God really wants is morality, not really a kosher kitchen. It's not what goes into the mouth that defiles a man, but what comes out. So now, it is okay to eat anything. And in fact, there's this really fascinating episode in the New Testament where Peter has this dream that this sheet descends from heaven and it's teeming with all sorts of creatures. And God tells him, "Up, Peter, kill and eat." So it really is a new dietary dispensation. We'll see. Oddly, it doesn't last very long, and Christianity eventually does set up its own dietary strictures. But for the moment, at least in the very start of Christianity, absolutely everything is okay to eat. And I should mention all the other laws are transformed also. There's no more circumcision, there's no more stoning people. All those laws change.
If you're enjoying this podcast and want more of the same, you can find hundreds of audio courses on all sorts of topics, all taught by brilliant professors like Ken Albala, at thegreatcoursesplus.com/podcasts, the new audio and video streaming site from The Great Courses, the leader in lifelong learning. Featuring in-depth courses on subjects ranging from how to use spices in cooking, investing, speaking Greek, Hinduism, and a whole lot more. At The Great Courses Plus, you can learn everything about anything.
I think more than any other individual, it's really Paul who invents Christianity as a distinct religion. And let me explain what I mean by that. First of all, he is the first to call Jesus by the name of Christos in Greek, which means anointed one. And in fact, it's a translation of Moshiach in Hebrew, that also means anointed with oil. Okay, he's also the first who said that anybody can join, and he began to actively get converts from outside the Jewish community. He was the first to call these followers Christians and told them that Jesus was a mediator between humans and God. It was still not official doctrine that he was both human and divine. That comes much, much later. But I think the most important thing is that Paul stressed that it's not only okay to suffer, but that it's positively good. And what he did was turn what would have been defeat for any other religious group into a triumph. The idea is that to die for one's faith is a positive good. Being downtrodden gets you into heaven. And good is no longer, as it was with the Greeks and Romans, a matter of strength and virility and beauty. It is actually being lowly, poor, and oppressed. And your reward is not here on earth with fame and things like that. It's the eternal life. That's what your reward is. And who cares if this world is terrible? There's a better one waiting for the good and meek people. And this attitude, as we will see, is essential to understanding early Christian food ways. You can imagine how this religion caught on like wildfire in the empire. Eventually, they had to figure out a way to organize these new communities. You know, they start in secret. There's a sign of a fish, or the ichthys, which is an anagram for Jesus Christos Theou Iosoter, Jesus Christ, God's Son, Savior, and it stands for a fish. And they used to draw the symbol on the sand wherever they were meeting so they could remain secret. And that's because they were really actively persecuted. Remember, Paul was beheaded on the way to Rome during Nero's reign. Peter is thrown into chains and later crucified. But they did begin to organize, nonetheless, into physical buildings or ecclesia, which are overseen by bishops, or the word is episcopus. And they were all linked back to the disciples who wrote them letters, communicated with them. And what we have is the slow development of the institution of the church as a religious authority, with priests acting as mediators between ordinary people and God, and eventually a father or pope, which is what the Bishop of Rome will be called, as the spiritual head of the church, at least in the West. In the East, they have other patriarchs. Now, it may seem odd, since it seems like Jesus' original intentions might have been to have everyone act as priest, right? And any place would serve equally well for worship, right? You don't need a physical structure like the temple, he was saying quite often. But the holy space And the ritually pure and celibate priest does catch on anyway and becomes central to Christian practice. The persecutions get more intense. Often people willingly accepted martyrdom. I mean, St. Stephen's the first martyr, but there a whole slew of people end up being killed for their faith. This is going to sound gruesome, but their bodies would often be dismembered after their death, and the parts would be saved and venerated as relics. And the logic is that these relics had so much grace that just going and visiting them got you merit. And more people join despite the persecutions, and different kinds of people too. There's a very interesting food discussion that takes place in the letter to the Corinthians. And the letter, the question is sent, and it asks, is it okay for a Christian to eat food that's been sacrificed to heathen gods? Remember, they said okay to eat everything, but the Greeks, if you remember, they sacrifice meat before they eat it, and then they share it publicly in a festival. And so in Corinth, a Greek city, they're wondering, can we go and join in on the barbecue? And what's decided is that no, it really isn't a sin, because you don't believe in the pagan gods, so it's not like you're submitting to them. But on the other hand, it would be better if you don't go, because what if the guy standing next to you, he's not so convinced? You might lead your brother astray, and that person might start believing them because they're always going to pagan temples and they're always given free meals. So isn't it interesting how all these societies and their food customs intersect right here, right? We're talking about the ancient Greeks and the Jewish Christian community, and it really is fascinating to me. So also note that in the process of conversion, many local practices were accommodated. That is that in many places that became Christian, in order to ease the process of conversion, they allowed many purely pagan practices to continue. Sometimes a holy spring or a well could become a healing shrine or a place of pilgrimage, or a local deity might be subsumed as a saint. Now, I'll discuss this practice more fully when we get to the Middle Ages, but just realize that even at this point, pagan practices, including food practices, right? Think of eggs at Easter, and perhaps a pagan fertility rite to start. And even pagan deities were not always totally eradicated when Christianity arrived. But let me discuss some of the food rituals that do develop in the early church. The most important of these is the fast. Now, if you remember, Judaism itself had fasts, right? But in Christianity, they become a lot more important. And the idea is that the body really isn't so important, but the soul is. The body is just a temporary dwelling place for the much more important and, of course, immortal soul. And the body is sort of a distraction. So if you can mortify the flesh, that means kind of to kill it, right? By denying, you can't really kill yourself, but by denying the body its physical urges, things like eating and sex and sleeping regularly, then you can make the soul all the more strong. It's a kind of exercise. In fact, ascetic means exercise. So Christianity from an early date begins to stress this asceticism, and that's something really very foreign from Judaism. And among the early Christians, there were these, let's call them heroic ascetics, people who went out into the desert and fasted, like St. Anthony, or St. Simeon, who goes up a column and stays there for years. And the early writers, people like Tertullian and Basil, who explain the need to fast, they also apply this really interesting medical rationale. What they argue is that nutritious and hot foods, things like meat, create more flesh and blood on our bodies. And the excess of that flesh and blood is called a plethora in Greek. Remember, these are Greek thinkers, right? That plethora is then converted into sperm. And in fact, that happens in both men and women. They both have sperm. That's a standard Galenic idea. And so to remain chaste, it's best to consume cold foods, things like vegetables and fish. And we'll see that this logic lingers for centuries in this tradition of having fish on Fridays and fast days. But let's look at what some of these early ascetics did. Taken from the sayings of the early church fathers, these ascetics tended to live alone, but gradually they start living in communities, or what we would call monasteries. The word abbot comes from the word Abba, meaning father in Aramaic, and the brothers would be the members of the order. Their lives entailed communal living, celibacy, strict obedience, sometimes vows of silence. So you wonder, what do these folks do all day? Well, some orders work with their hands, basically to feed themselves, and they would have gardens, grow medicinal herbs. But for the most part, what these people do is pray all day, all night. They say the Holy Office. They celebrate the Mass. And they also stay up, so they're saying it all through the night also. They eat very little food, and they, in fact, seem to go out of their way to suffer. There's one monk who weaves a plate of palm leaves, and he never changes the water, even though it starts to stink. And someone asks him why, and he says, "So I can suffer." And it's kind of a matter of self-control also. There's one abbot who keeps a little bottle of oil on his shelf, and he doesn't touch it for 3 years. Another decides he's going to stop eating cooked food, and then he stops eating vegetables. There's another who drinks some wine so that he can go the whole day without any water in order that he might crucify himself. Notice the language here. My favorite story, and it's horrid, but there's a guy who's singing next to an old monk, and he coughs up a big wad of phlegm, and it lands on his cloak, and the guy's about to get really angry and yell at him, and instead he decides to eat it. So what's going on here psychologically? It's a matter of self-mastery. It's conquering the body's needs, subduing them. And why is the question? It's really a matter of resentment, I think. I mean, it's a kind of hatred for the rest of the world that gets to enjoy all of these pleasures, and the monk can't. And since they really have no power over the rest of the world, except the self-satisfaction that someday they're going to go to heaven and sinners won't, where do they release all of that pent-up aggression and frustration? Well, think about it. All the things they're denying themselves, these are basic human biological needs. They're necessary for survival. Food, sleep, reproduction. I think maybe even getting angry. It's a survival instinct, right? It's got to be frustrating to give them up. And where do they vent this pent-up anger and frustration? On themselves. It's this self-torture for people who, have nothing else to control in life. And obviously, that's a very Freudian reading. You know, there are other ways to think about it. But you know, maybe people can live happily without satisfying nature's basic callings. But it seems very hard in my mind. Note also how they like testing themselves. There's this guy in Palestine who wants to eat a cucumber, and he leaves it there to see how long he can bear the torment. And he sits in the sun for 5 days in the middle of the heat. The cucumber is supposed to be refreshing, so it would be like having a glass of lemonade and just setting it out there and sitting out in the hot sun and saying, "I'm not going to drink that." And they start competing with each other to see who can torment themselves the most. The other side of the coin is that gluttony becomes one of the seven deadly sins. Before it might be physicians telling you, yeah, you shouldn't eat too much, you'll harm your body, too many refined foods are bad. But now it's a matter of imperiling your mortal soul. And the images of the damned in hell, they show their punishment. You know, gluttons are perpetually stuffed until they burst, and then they become whole again, and it repeats for eternity. So food has become a sin. And there's also now an explicit idea of devils or demons tempting people to commit sin, like the monk who steals a roll. And he ends up, in the end, confessing, and the devil is killed. So, although these acts of ascetic heroism are exceptional, several ritual fasts eventually become ingrained in the Christian calendar. And fasting doesn't really mean total abstinence from food. Strangely, it rarely does. Here it means abstaining from animal food or any animal product like milk, eggs, or butter, having one meal a day. But fish are okay. Although the custom varies from place to place, for the next 1,000 years or so, generally, people were supposed to fast every Saturday, starting Friday night, sometimes every Wednesday, and then that whole period of Lent from Ash Wednesday to Easter. Many people also abstained from sex at this time. They avoided luxuries, and the idea was a moderate subduing of the flesh to purify the body, strengthen the soul, and prepare for the holiday. And we'll return to this in the Middle Ages. But to give you an idea of what a penitent diet would be like, let's make a wild salad. So here is the very penitential salad, such as would have been eaten by the desert fathers, monks wandering around picking wild herbs and deciding to live off of them. And of course, salads are always medicinal in the ancient world. They give you certain humoral qualities, but this salad specifically is designed to curb lust. In other words, it's made with cold and moist or cold and dry herbs, for the most part, that will subdue the heat and passion of your libido, if you will. And the things to add to this salad are herbs like mallows, which are very cold, sorrel, really nice and sour, cold and dry herb, tansy, which has got a beautiful bitterness. And you can see there's a kind of balancing of flavors here. It's not completely random. Also some hyssop. I would add some parsley just for flavor. It's a really lovely herb, as well as some vervain, and burnet is added as well, which is a beautiful, a cucumber-like flavor. And the logic of this is like you'd make really any salad, but I would be very sparing on the oil because you want to be quite penitent. So just add a tiny little bit of oil to your bowl, add a little bit of vinegar, that's also a cold kind of condiment, and then add your greens as much as you like, the mallows, and tear them up. You know, you don't really want to cut them. You want them in nice big hunks. The sorrel, which you can buy in the supermarket too. Sorrel is lovely. Some tansy, and you want to strip this off of the stems if they're a little bit too tough. Take those off. Here's a little bit of hyssop, some vervain I'm adding to this, and these should really go nicely together. Torn up, and here I'm going to add some burnet to this as well. Burnet goes really nicely in cocktails as well. It gives you a cucumber flavor, but of course the ancients wouldn't have done that. And there's some of the parsley, and I'm just going to toss that up together. You can do the proportions as you like, but you can see, doesn't that really look like punishment? Lastly, St. Benedict's monastic rule. St. Benedict of Nursia was the individual who shaped Western monasticism by writing a set of laws for his monks at Monte Cassino. He describes the kitchen duties the brother has to do in turn, exactly how much food they're allowed to eat in each meal, how many different dishes. They were also allowed a hemina of wine a day, although he says wine isn't really good for monks, but we know how hard it would be to convince them of otherwise. What these last comments reveal is that monasteries, especially because individuals can't own or squander wealth or property and they can't pass it on to children, they tend to grow wealthy and sometimes even luxurious. And we'll see it's why periodically there are reform movements within monasticism to reintroduce austerity and a penitential way of life. But first, we have to turn to the rest of Europe after the fall of Rome in the age of the barbarian invasions.
Thanks for listening to Episode 10 of Food, A Cultural Culinary History. Just a reminder, if you're enjoying this podcast and want more of the same, you can find hundreds of audio courses on all sorts of topics, all taught by brilliant professors like Ken Albala, at thegreatcoursesplus.com/podcasts. Featuring in-depth courses on subjects ranging from philosophy, wellness, art appreciation, history, science, business, you name it. At The Great Courses Plus, you can learn everything about anything.